views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
On the cutting edge of the new mainstream, Christine Upchurch is passionate about bringing together science, psychology, and spirituality in a way that can be applied to our everyday lives for true transformation. The Christine Upchurch Show, stellar conversations to illuminate your journey, engages some of the most inspired visionaries on the planet in lighthearted, lively dialogue. Join us as we explore the expansive nature of reality in a down-to-earth way, offering you insights and tools empowering you to become that bright light you're meant to be. Now, here's your host, Christine Upchurch.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Christine Upchurch Show, where we have stellar conversations to illuminate your journey. I'm speaking to you today from sunny Seattle. Woo! Here on KKNW AM 1150 radio. You might be listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, or New York on 1230 AM WBLQ, on one of the 35 stations in Australia, or anywhere around the world on Transformation Talk Radio. But I tell you, whether you're listening live or listening in the archives on ChristineUpchurch.com, you're going to be glad you joined us here today because we're going to be talking about something fascinating, which we have never talked about on this show before. But before I tell you what that is, I want to say hello to my better half here in the studio who allows you to hear these wonderful conversations, Mr. Benny Mathers. Good morning, Benny.
Good morning. Sunny spring in Seattle. We'll take it.
Yes, we will. Of course, I have pulled up the weather forecast. And the whole next week.
Now stop it!
So we better get out there and enjoy it today.
You got it. I'm not even looking at that right now. I'm focusing on today and today only. Yes.
Right. Right. Yeah. So you know, the old joke is, what happens when summer comes in Seattle? Everyone goes out for a picnic that day.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Right. Yes.
Totally.
Yes.
I'll be doing this show remotely then at that point because we'll be out on a picnic.
Exactly. Oh, okay. Yeah. Or we'll do a replay.
Even better. Don't tell the boss.
Okay. I won't. You know, I'm fascinated by the topic today. It's a topic that we've never talked about here on the show before. It's about being a replacement child. What happens when a child dies and then another child is born into that family afterwards? What kind of effect does that have on people? What happens to that child as she or he is growing up? And you know, does it change the dynamics of the family? Does it change some of the issues that the individual who's the child who follows has to deal with it when they grow up? Today's guest is Dr. Barbara Jaffe. She is the author of When Will I Be Good Enough? A Replacement Child's Journey to Healing. And she is an English professor at El Camino College in California. She's award-winning. She's a fellow in UCLA's Department of Education. She's offered countless workshops to students to help them find their writers' voices through writing nonfiction. Her college has honored her in a couple of different ways. She was named Outstanding Woman of the Year and also Distinguished Teacher of the Year. Originally a fourth-generation San Franciscan, Barbara has lived in L.A. her entire adult life, and she's married to a psychiatrist. She's raised three sons. And I understand she's got at least one or two grandkids, as well as a dog. I'm so glad to have her here today, Dr. Barbara Jaffe. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you so much, Christine and Benny. Thank you for having me on the show today.
You know, Barbara, I had never actually heard about some of these issues until the associate producer, Peggy Snow, brought this to my attention. Can you just share with our listeners your background and why this is a topic that's near and dear to your heart?
Sure. So a replacement child is a child that is born into a family after the family had been completed. So the parents had the children and life was continuing. Sadly and suddenly a child dies and the family decides to have another child to replace that child. Mm-hmm. And that's where I come in. I have an older brother who's almost 7 years older than I. Then I had another brother who passed away when he was about two.
Wow.
And then I was born to replace him. His name was Jeffrey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what defined my role as a replacement child more than perhaps it could have been was the lack of communication about what happened, and the, especially for my mother, a lack of dealing with that grief.
Okay.
And loss.
Right. And I, you know, as a mother myself, I think that losing a child must be the very worst thing that can happen to us in life. And so, you know, their son, you know, who would have been your brother, how did he die at age two?
He contracted meningitis at a time before there were any kind of inoculations for that. Uh-huh. And within 6 weeks, he died.
Wow.
And you're right. It is the worst thing to have the thought of losing a child. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So he passes away and your parents must be in terrible pain emotionally.
Yes. My father worked very hard at his business. So he was, I think he found solace in that. And my mother really was very depressed. Understandably so, so much so that soon after it happened, her doctor paid her a house visit, and she tells me that the therapy was he literally slapped her across the face and said, "You need to move on. You have a child, have another one." Mm-hmm. And, you know, how can anyone really get over that?
Yes.
And she would recount that, but that's pretty much, she didn't really say too much about Jeffrey over the years, except there were photos around the house, so I knew that he existed.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very depressed off and on throughout her life. I know she loved me. She did the best she could, but at times her love was conditional, unlike my father.
Well, you know, I think about somebody who's experienced that kind of pain, you know, absolutely loving and enduring, you know, a child and then losing that child. It probably makes you a little gun-shy for opening your heart fully to your other children.
I think you're so right about that. And when I was younger, and even as I grew older, and even with my own kids, when I would be sick, she would just absolutely fall apart.
Wow.
And I remember as a child, I would try to do my best to hide my illnesses, if it was the flu or a cough or a cold, and she'd tell me to stay home, and I'd say no. You know, I would have to be so sick to have to stay home because I didn't want to upset her.
Right.
It really became my life's mission to make her as happy as I could.
And therein lies a huge dysfunction, the child trying to take care of the mother.
True. And what was interesting is that I never saw myself as a replacement child. I never defined myself as that.
Uh-huh.
These were all kind of subliminal messages that I internalized. And like most of us, when we grow up in our family of origin, we think that what we're experiencing is what other people experience.
Uh-huh.
My mother spending many days in bed, and I was just happy that she was home when I came home from school.
Mm-hmm.
So I adjusted to that. And I thought it was normal to want to be a perfectionist, want to be the best little girl so I didn't make her unhappy, and to try to make her days lighter.
Yeah. So it sounds to me like your mother never fully dealt with her grief.
I think that was it. And there wasn't a lot of communication about that. And we didn't really talk about feelings. And I was the kind of person as I am, I like to talk about things and process them and write about them and ask people how they feel. And that was not comfortable for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yet, you know, I think in terms of the energetics, somebody who has been involved in energy healing for many years, I think about how there's this dysfunction when the feelings are not getting processed, particularly feelings that are that deep and dark and difficult. And there you were trying to be the light in that situation and bring to the table the discussion of feelings. So it seems like a, you know, perfect in some ways and a perfect storm in other ways.
That's true. And I think from her point of view, it was probably I was at times too much to handle, only because I did want to talk about these very issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I know that there are probably many other children and adult children who, you know, are the replacement child. What are some of the issues that you have to deal with as the replacement child?
Well, there's actually something called a replacement child syndrome, which I thought, well, that's quite interesting, which I didn't realize until after I wrote the book. But when I looked through the list, I thought, wow, I have so many of those qualities. And one of them is being a perfectionist.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the idea of survivor's guilt. You know, why did I do remember my mother saying, if Jeffrey had lived, you wouldn't have been born. So I began to think, what did I do?
Yeah.
Yeah, what did I do? Even, you know, I didn't even know him.
Uh-huh.
Issues of low self-esteem, feeling less than,
right.
Anxiety. But what I write about is actually universal themes of feeling less than in areas of self-confidence, self-worth,
mm-hmm.
self-esteem.
Right.
And I think these are areas that a lot of people can relate to, even if they're not replacement children.
Yes. And I can absolutely relate to some of the things that you talk about in there, because I was the daughter of a mother who was a narcissist. And
yes.
She did her best to love me. And she was a wonderful mother in some ways. And yet there was this lack of true connection and intimacy. And so, yes, I've got the perfectionist qualities. I've got I've had the self-esteem issues. And so I could definitely relate to some of these things. I thought this is similar to, you know, what somebody would experience with a narcissist mother.
Right. And I think, you know, when we're in a family where we're compared to our siblings for whatever reason,
uh-huh.
or adoption issues or blended families, a lot of these same issues can come up.
That makes sense. Right. And yet, how can anybody ever be good enough to the compared to the memory of somebody who's passed away?
That's true. You're right.
Yeah. This is a fascinating topic. More with Dr. Barbara Jaffe here in just a few moments.
What is a brilliant culture? And how do we create them? Why are they important? Claudette Rowley has created a breakthrough 5-step process to help you design a culture that is authentic, innovative, and successful. Learn how to create change with Cultural Brilliance Radio, the DNA of organizational excellence, and Claudette Rowley. To learn more or work with Claudette, visit ClaudetteRowley.com.
Brand consultant Jen Morgan is here with Radically Distinct Radio to help you take control of your future and maximize your brand's power to produce results. Whether you're an individual trying to reinvent yourself and launch a new venture, or you're an executive trying to reposition your company to modernize your sales and marketing programs, Jen Morgan and the RAD Method empower you to play to your strengths and show up in the world as your most powerful brand. To learn more, go to jenmorgan.com. That's Jen with two N's, Morgan.com, or call 206-9000. 972-5366.
On the cutting edge of the new mainstream, Christine Upchurch is passionate about bringing together science, psychology, and spirituality in a way that can be applied to our everyday lives for true transformation. The Christine Upchurch Show, stellar conversations to illuminate your journey, engages some of the most outstanding visionaries on the planet in lively dialogue to inspire you to become that bright light you're meant to be. Join Christine every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time on KKNW, AM 1150, and Transformation Talk Radio.
Gifted intuitive healer and spiritual teacher Sarah Luce brings her unique style to the hit show Small Steps, Big Breakthrough Radio on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Tune in each month as Sarah turns reality on end and shows us how to experience expansive results with simple yet powerful steps. Expect an enlightening bend on what you currently believe is possible. For show details and upcoming topics, visit saraluce.com. That's SARALOOS.com.
I'm Christine Upchurch, and this is a Stellar Reflections Minute. Years ago, when facing cancer, without any immediate treatment options, I sought healing by making various life changes. For a while, I followed a very restrictive diet. I often found myself obsessing about which foods were good and which ones were bad. Then one day I realized I was consuming foods based on fear of not getting well. But I didn't want to make choices out of fear anymore. I decided it was far better for my immune system if I allowed myself to experience the joy that came from, say, eating frozen yogurt, than it was for me to ingest the fear that came from avoiding it. Now, instead of choosing healthy habits based on fear, I try to make choices because they feel right and ultimately bring me joy and ease. How many of your healthy habits are really based on fear? Please visit StellarReflections.com or call 425-999-9836. That's 425-999-9836.
Welcome back to the Christine Upchurch Show here on KKNW and Transformation Talk Radio. You know, Barbara, I'm fascinated by this subject of being a replacement child and the issues that come up. And you've talked some about what your mother's response was to your brother Jeffrey's death before you were ever, you know, conceived and born. How did your father respond to his death?
He was much more willing to talk about it, but he didn't talk about it unless I asked a question or two. And he did take me down to the garage where they stored his baby book, and he showed me the last entry of his baby book. And he showed us over the years a couple of the movies that he had taken, like Jeffrey's Last Christmas. Uh-huh. And he was more than willing to share. But I also got the feeling that there wasn't a lot of emphasis on wanting to talk about it. And I was sensitive to the fact that I didn't want to make him uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But I always got the feeling that he was able to, as much as any parent can, move on and be able to give me the love, you know, 100%.
Right. And that's very telling that the baby book was kept in the garage.
Yes. Well, we put a lot of things down there, and that was one of them. And it was very poignant, very sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You also had an older brother, you know?
Yes, I have an older brother.
And when he was a child, how was he affected by this whole dynamic?
Interesting question. He does not remember Jeffrey.
Really?
And yes, so Jeffrey was, I think Stephen was about 5 and a half when Jeffrey died, and he has no memory of him. And I used to look at old photos, and I saw Jeffrey and Stephen in matching coats, wool coats, in uh-huh. San Francisco, and holding hands on the street, and it was just so sweet and bittersweet. But he has no memory, and I thought there must have been a time where, after Jeffrey died, where maybe he stayed at my grandparents' house or something, think of the turmoil that must have gone on at that time. But he has no memory.
That's kind of surprising, considering he was
yes.
over 5. I mean, most
right.
kids have memories from when they were like 3 or something. And
at least that sporadic kind of
yeah.
hazy way of remembering kindergarten or an event, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, and if Jeffrey wasn't talked about in the family and if there wasn't a lot of, a lot of cooperative healing regarding it, then perhaps he just sort of shut down.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely true.
Okay, so you shared with us before some of the effects that being a replacement child can have, the low self-esteem, the perfectionism. What other kinds of effects can there be? How did it affect you personally? I'm thinking in terms of with food.
For me, the idea of feeling out of control in my life and my mother so in control uh-huh. manifested for me in an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. So when I was younger, I was very chubby. Uh-huh. I loved food, uh-huh. and I ate a lot. My mother got to a point, I think, when I must have been about 10 or 11, she told me to watch it, which was code word for you're getting fat and you need mm-hmm. to lose weight. And I was also very sensitive to that. So I did start to watch it, and I took it too far, and I became anorexic,
uh-huh.
which in those days, I didn't really know what it was at the time. I only knew that I received a lot of attention from my mother, and it got to the point where she was forcing me to eat, which that kind of felt positive.
Uh-huh.
And I also was able to fit in smaller clothing, and that, as I said, had carried me through. Even currently, I have what they call body dysmorphia, in the sense that when I look at myself in the mirror, I don't see what other people see,
mm-hmm.
and I have to just act as if. So these kinds of issues have carried through, although I have worked very hard on myself over the years to make sure that they don't define me.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Barbara, I think that there are many, many women who have these issues who weren't the replacement child.
Absolutely.
So now that you've learned more about replacement children, have you heard of men who were replacement children having had these kinds of eating disorders?
I haven't heard about the men having eating disorders, although I know that eating disorders in men have been increasing.
Uh-huh.
Before, it was generally considered just a female issue.
Right, right.
But I have heard stories where replacement children, the new child is actually named the same name as the child who passed away.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Oh, yeah. That's so toxic.
It absolutely.
Yeah.
So I don't always feel that I lived in the shadow of Jeffrey, but the legacy of my mother's depression, I think, is what defined me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I can understand how when a child has been lost, you know, has passed over, how the parents want to feel what they felt for that child again in a relationship, and it can never happen because, you know, you've got, what, three children, and you've got a couple of grandchildren. You know, you and I have got two children. We know that each child who incarnates in a human form is different, regardless of whether they're the same family. Even when they're twins, they have different personalities.
That's right. And it's wonderful to have the diversity. Mm-hmm. and to celebrate those differences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on one hand, it was positive that I was a girl.
Uh-huh.
After two sons.
Yes.
She said that, you know, she always wanted a daughter. And on the other hand, I think quite ironically, in many ways, she favored boys.
Uh-huh.
She reacted very positively to my sons, which was a true gift.
Uh-huh.
She had infinite love and unconditional love for them in a way that she didn't always have with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her interactions with my brother were different based on his gender.
Right. Okay, so you are a mother now. You were brought up in this situation where the dynamics of the family was not typical because you followed a child who'd passed. So what are some of the issues that you've had to deal with when you're parenting your own children?
Well, I think for me, it was, I understood that my mother took up a lot of space in our house. That house really revolved around her,
uh-huh.
how she felt and her moods. And what I made a concerted effort as a mother to have virtually no needs, that the focus was on my children and my husband and what they needed and wanted. And I did not want them to have to worry about me and think about me and make that an issue. So I went the other extreme,
uh-huh.
which I don't think was positive either.
Right. And of course, it may be a continuation of the self-worth issues associated with growing up. It's kind of like the others are more important.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, as a mother, my mother had a lot of adages, and one of hers was that mothers of sons are selfish. And I could never really understand what that meant.
How strange.
How strange. And I said, well, you have a son. She goes, but you only son. And so, and I just could not understand that. And I went through, I write about this in my book,
uh-huh.
and the person I was thinking about is her mother-in-law, my paternal grandmother, who had two sons, my father and my uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, yes, she's selfish. And I, of course, it's silliness that there's no such thing like that, but,
right.
but that's the way I brought up. And so the idea that I would do anything for myself as a mother, especially of sons,
mm-hmm.
which I'd immediately think I was being selfish.
Right. Oh, so has there been a point in your life when you've started to kind of truly heal and integrate and sort of balance out both your needs and the needs of others in this way?
Yes, and I wish there had been a moment in time which I could have defined as my, you know, transformation, my aha, but really it's been a very slow growth. From the time I left to go to college, I knew that there were pieces of myself that were just, I don't know, different, and that I needed to fix them in order to live a peaceful, wonderful, positive life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is definitely the message of my book, that despite whatever challenges we all go through, which we do, we can have a fulfilling life. But I knew for me that it just seems that other people were going through different stages of their lives a little bit more effortlessly than me, and I had to work so hard for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think with every big decision or getting married, having children, I made those decisions pretty easily, but afterwards, it was how was I going to negotiate these different roles, getting a career, and so that's when having low self-esteem, self-confidence, self-worth, that's where I felt, so I needed to work on those issues so that I could have all of those things, and it's been, my whole life I've been working on it.
Mm-hmm. And you have had a very impressive career. You're award-winning professor, and you've taught others in a variety of ways and touched many lives. Have you had issues with self-esteem within relation to your work?
Actually, my work and my education were probably the one area that I carved out totally for myself that I felt more confident in.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were not educated after high school, my brother either. So my family of origin, education, they're more into business, so education wasn't a focus. So I created that niche for myself. But areas where I wanted to be perfect and the best actually worked to the advantage to my students because I wanted to be the best teacher. Uh-huh. I wanted to give them everything. And so in a way, that was good,
mm-hmm.
But then it also, feeling like that all the time can deplete you. So
right. If you're looking for external validation of your worth, then
that's right.
That does take a lot of energy, and eventually it can't fill that hole.
And you're right. I was looking for external validation in all areas of my life.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of mother was I? What kind of professor was I? What kind of wife was I, and how everyone thought about my food, and that gets to be very exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
You've
probably shared a lot of positive things with people because of your desire to be the best.
Yes, and so it did work to my advantage in some points, but then I realized that I needed to nurture myself, and mm-hmm. I think that was the piece that was missing.
Mm-hmm. So how have you gone about healing yourself?
Well, I've spent a lot of time reading metaphysical books.
Uh-huh.
I have gone into therapy. I have taken myself on retreats, meditation, writing retreats. I've spent a lot of time writing and looking inward and examining the pieces that it might initially seem uncomfortable to do,
mm-hmm.
but I also, that's where I found the answers.
All right. Do you feel that you've ever been able to heal the relationship with your mother?
I do. I know that she loved me, and I absolutely loved her, and before she passed away, I made sure that she knew that, even though I know she knew that. I literally said that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it was the best it could be.
Right.
And with the tools that she had, I know it was the best it could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that becoming a parent ourselves helps us to understand the difficulties that our own parents may have had. And yet, as children, even as grown-up children, middle-aged grown-up children, we still have needs that were never met. And so it takes a lot to grow through those and heal.
Yes, absolutely. It is a process, but you're right. When we become parents, taking care of someone else, we realize it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And we all do the best we can do.
Right.
And so I have come to realize that I am good enough. I don't have to be the best parent in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to be the best at anything. In fact, one person once told me, a therapist said, being good enough is okay. But
uh-huh.
I didn't quite understand it then, but I see it now.
Right. And that perfectionism is hard to let go of.
It is.
Yeah. We're going to go to a quick break now. More with Dr. Barbara Jaffe when we return.
What if your body and mind were the compasses to the secrets, mysteries, and magic of life? Glenna Rice, co-host of The Questionable Parent, is inviting you to access all that is possible. Glenna is a 10-year certified veteran access consciousness facilitator who offers an amazing variety of life-changing classes and workshops. Work with Glenna from anywhere with teleclasses and workshops all over the globe. To learn more and see Glenna's current schedule of events, classes, and workshops, visit glennarice.com.
I'm Christine Upchurch, and this is a Stellar Reflections Minute. For centuries, spiritual traditions have talked about how humans have an energy field, or aura, surrounding them. Although skeptical scientists refuted this for decades, science is now beginning to catch up with spirituality. Scientists can actually measure light emanating from living beings, so they can measure the human aura, which in scientific terms is known as the biofield. Many medical practitioners around the world use an instrument to evaluate a patient's biofield for the purpose of diagnosing illness. They understand that imbalanced or insufficient light in a person's energy field indicates a physical or emotional problem. The good news? There are ways to balance and increase your light, resulting in greater well-being. For more information, please check out stellarreflections.com or call 425-999-9836. That's 425-999-9836.
Tune in to Dynamics of Diversity Radio, scripting the new narrative for immigration with leading experts Kripa Upadhya and Steve Tanijo on TransformationTalkRadio.com. This show will remove the noise that often accompanies discussions on this topic and share a new perspective on the dynamics of immigration and diversity, ever reminding us that together we are all at the core of innovation, excellence, and positive change. Visit OrbitLawPLLC.com for upcoming topics.
Have you been seeing numbers like 111 and 222 everywhere you go? Do you feel that the universe may be trying to get your attention, perhaps offering a message of some sort? As it turns out, numerical patterns and certain types of geometry form the very fabric of our reality, from cells under a microscope to the astronomy of our night sky. At Stellar Reflections, we offer special sessions which tap into these patterns, designed specifically to support you on your journey. The 111 and 222 activations are sessions activating new patterns in your energy field, which in turn can help you create new patterns in your life. After just one session with a practitioner, either in person or via distance, clients report gaining greater clarity, becoming more intuitive, and honoring their inner truth as they move forward in their lives. Curious about what these transformational sessions might do for you? Call 425-999-9836 or visit stellarreflections.com. That's StellarReflections.com. Welcome back to the Christine Upchurch Show here on KKNW and Transformation Talk Radio. You know, Barbara, before we continue the conversation, I want to make sure that you share with our listeners how they can connect with you and how they can find the book.
Okay. The best way would be to go onto my website. I'll say it and then spell it, BarbaraAnnJaffe.com. That's BarbaraAnnJaffe.com. And on the website is information about how to get my book and information about me and some of my interviews and some books that I recommend and a little bit more about my journey.
And yours is a fascinating journey. And also, it seems like whether somebody's a replacement child or the child of a narcissist or, you know, fill in the blank, it seems like Many of us cannot get through our childhood without collecting some wounds that we have to deal with later. What's your recommendation for people who have faced challenges? And what are some of the things you did that anybody can do to help themselves heal?
I think again, some of these things didn't come naturally to me. I had to learn them. And one of them was to focus on myself and my own needs. And not in a selfish way, but to really listen to my inner voice and what I needed. Uh-huh. And I kind of use a couple metaphors. One would be the burnt toast syndrome that I think made perhaps a lot of women, mothers have when you're making something and it gets burnt like a piece of toast. Uh-huh. Rather than throw it out, I'd say, well, I'll eat the burnt toast, even though I really don't want it. I'll give the good toast to everybody else.
Right.
And so I thought, I don't have to eat the burnt toast either. Uh-huh. No one has to eat the burnt toast. Right. I can make croutons or decide not to. Uh-huh. And again, it might sound silly, but these are little things where the focus begins to, it begins to be on myself.
Mm-hmm. So do you find that it's helpful to sort of parent yourself as a wiser, better parent than what your mother could be?
Yes, because I felt that I didn't have any needs, but of course we all do. So it's just being gentle with myself, like mm-hmm. I am to my friends. Why wouldn't I treat myself the same way that I treat my friends?
Right, right.
So that is definitely something that's helped me a lot. And to rewrite some of the scripts that did not serve me.
So tell me what the script once was and how you've rewritten it.
We had talked a little bit about being perfect.
Uh-huh.
And that I wasn't worthy unless my food was a certain way that I cooked, or at least, and if my boys acted a certain way, or uh-huh. if I did this lesson, that I just kind of gave myself a break, that it was okay to say no to someone mm-hmm. without, you know, I used to say yes about everything. And the earth did not stop turning. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I could say that I can say no if I don't want to do something, that I don't have to have a perfect meal. I don't have to make everything from scratch.
Uh-huh.
I can buy things. These are little things, but when they add up, it's transformational. And another lesson for me was to minimize my expectations. I came to realize that expectations were planned disappointments.
Oh, just expectations about yourself or expectations of others?
I think for myself, I can have expectations.
Uh-huh.
For others, no, that's where it's because I would expect, for example, that other people would know what was going on in my head. My husband, who I've been with forever, he would ask me what's wrong, and I'd say nothing, you know, with that voice of, you know, there's something wrong. And I used to think, well, he should know what I'm thinking. And mm-hmm. then I realized no one should know what I'm thinking.
Uh-huh.
I need to tell him what I need, what I want, as I would tell anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And that has really freed me to have the minimal expectations of other people. I'm setting myself up.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you've come from a childhood where you had to sort of look at your mother's behavior, feel what her mood was like, and sort of alter your behavior accordingly. And when somebody hasn't been raised with that kind of sensitivity, then of course they're not going to perceive things in the same way.
That's so true. And you're right about that sensitivity. And it's no wonder that my major was linguistics, which is the study of languages. I was very astute in picking up reading between the lines and reading languages and facial expressions and you know, different sounds without words. I could pick that up.
Uh-huh.
I was very sensitive to that.
So in terms of, you know, how you parented differently with your own children, what have the pluses and minuses been relating to that?
I have gotten to the point where I don't give advice unless asked.
Uh-huh.
Rather than my mother telling me what I should do,
uh-huh.
I have given my boys over the years the space. Of course, when they were little, it's different, but they're grown men now.
Uh-huh.
And unless they ask my opinion, I don't give it, which means I'm not talking that much anymore. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly realized people aren't asking my opinion. Uh-huh. And if they do, then I know they really want it. And that's been, I think, giving them their own space. It's been very important.
Right. So did your mother pass along the fear of losing a child when you were a mother? Do you feel like as a mother that you were worried about losing one of your sons?
No. Interesting question. I've never been asked that. And that's very interesting. I never had those fears. I, as every mother, when they're flying somewhere, I always ask them to text me when they land, and they're very good about that. But once in a while, I'm thinking they're driving around the freeways in L.A., and that's scary,
yeah.
no matter
yeah.
how old they are.
Right.
But then I detach, and I just, no. So I didn't have that, mm-hmm. which I'm thankful for.
So have you ever felt a connection with the soul of Jeffrey?
I have, and that's a wonderful question, because when I started to write the book, I've been through many drafts, I wrote it from his voice, and I wrote it from Jeffrey, who I feel has been with me my entire life, and I could not sustain that voice as the book went on, because mm-hmm. it wasn't my voice.
Right.
But it was an interesting way in which to get my writing going. Because I do feel he has guided me. There were many times when I literally did not know what the next chapter would be, because I did not have a trajectory of how I knew the book was going to evolve. And mm-hmm. I used to sit at the computer and talk to him and pray and just say, show me the next indicated step in terms of the pages. And they unfolded.
So do you feel that there may have been a soul contract between you and Jeffrey to play out this scenario?
I've often felt that and haven't shared that with a lot of people, but I have felt that there was a reason why he could only live a couple years, and then there was a reason why I was born.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely do feel that way. Yeah.
So I know that you talk a lot about the woundedness associated with this, as well as the healing. What has been the gift of this dysfunctional situation?
It has made me work very hard and to appreciate all my hard-earned winnings. My winnings, when I'm referring to, are my inner self that has come to such a beautiful fruition.
Mm-hmm.
I've been able to take myself apart, in essence, and examine the pieces and put myself back together into what I consider to be probably a more beautiful and intricate tapestry than I could have ever had if I just started out that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's beautiful, because I think that there's so many of us who have had woundedness, and some of it we've healed and some of it we have not. And yet, you know, when I look back on my own life, I think, oh, you know, if these supposedly negative things hadn't happened to me, I wouldn't be who I am today, and I wouldn't be sharing with people the way I am today. So there's the easy path, and then there's a difficult path, and there are a lot of gifts along the difficult path.
Absolutely. And not to see ourselves as victims, but to see that we can really make amazing lives for ourselves. We just have to look inward and do that work.
Mm-hmm. So at what point do you feel that you gave up sort of feeling like a victim?
I don't believe that I ever saw myself as a victim, because I never defined myself as a replacement child.
Uh-huh.
But I did see that I had some wounds that I needed to heal, but I never really blamed them. I was never a blamer where I said, you know, it's because of my mother or because of so-and-so that I'm that way.
Uh-huh.
I took responsibility, but I also knew that it was hard work, but I wasn't willing to give up.
Mm-hmm. And that's great that you didn't see yourself as a victim, because I think that there are so many people who face different kinds of challenges and fall into victimhood and get a lot of somehow positive sort of energy, you know, allow themselves to feed off their victimhood.
I always tell my students that we stop blaming our parents when we turn 18, because we're in charge of our lives now.
Right.
And
you do teach students, and including teaching them writing. When somebody sits down to write about their story, to help process their woundedness, what advice would you have for them?
I would just not put any limitations on what they're about to write, and then to just explore. a lot of my students are very tentative at first, and they say, I don't have anything to write about. Uh-huh. And I remind them, Flannery O'Connor said, anyone who has survived childhood has enough information to write a lifetime on.
Oh, I and love so that I, quote. That's great.
Isn't that a great quote?
Yeah.
I start off by having them write about their names. This is something so very basic. We never really spend time talking or writing about our names, uh-huh. how we feel about them, how we got them, where they came from, experiences. And it's really a good way to create a writer's voice in which they can dive deeply into the thoughts that they have.
Uh-huh. I love that. And any 30 seconds worth of advice for people facing challenges or processing old challenges?
I think it's so important to see ourselves being on a journey, and that the journey can be beautiful. I'd like to end with a quote by Ursula Le Guin, when
okay.
she writes, it is good to have an end to journey towards, but it is the journey that matters in the end.
Oh, that's beautiful. You know, Barbara, this hour has flown by, and I'm so grateful you joined me here today. Before we get off, I want to lead people to your website again. It's barbaraannjaffe.com. That's BarbaraAnnJaffe.com. Thank you so much for joining us here today. I really appreciate this, and I appreciate you illuminating a topic that we have never explored before here on this show.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Oh, my pleasure. And thank you for joining us here today. And I truly appreciate you joining us here, and I look forward to talking to you again soon. Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Christine Upchurch Show, stellar conversations to illuminate your journey. Each week, this show engages some of the most outstanding visionaries on the planet in lively dialogue to inspire you to become that bright light you're meant to be. Join Christine every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time on KKNW, AM 1150, and TransformationTalkRadio.com. For more information about the transformative healing work of Christine, visit www.stellarreflections.com. And for weekly topics, visit www.transformationtalkradio.com.